Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Hurra Podcast, dem Design-Podcast der Burg Giebichenstein Kunsthochschule in Halle. Und ich freue mich unglaublich, dass das die 50. Folge ist. Die große, kleine Jubiläumsfolge, die wir die ganze Zeit schon vor uns herschieben, weil wir nämlich, Probleme hatten, einen guten Termin zu finden, an dem wir mit unseren Podcast-Gästen, nämlich Frau Ma Phantasma, sprechen konnten. Das haben wir jetzt geschafft und deswegen veröffentlichen wir auch gleich den Podcast. Und es gibt zwei Sachen, die ich vorher noch tun möchte. Das erste ist Danke sagen. Ich bedanke mich an dieser Stelle ganz herzlich bei Leonie Fischer, die inzwischen ja auch schon viele Folgen moderiert hat, aber vor allen Dingen im Hintergrund so eine unglaublich gute Arbeit macht und alles für Instagram und die verschiedenen Plattformen bereitstellt. Sie hat es geerbt von Cleo Dörling, die das am Anfang des Podcasts gemacht hat. Auch an Cleo, an dich vielen Dank. Ich bedanke mich auch beim Rektorat, bei der Öffentlichkeitsarbeit der Burg für das Vertrauen am Anfang, aber eben auch das durchgehende Vertrauen, dass das, was wir hier machen, schon richtig ist. Und ich bedanke mich auch, und das ist vielleicht das Besondere an dieser Folge, bei Joshua, aka Indie Joe, ein Student der Burg Giebichenstein Kunsthochschule Halle im Industriedesign, der unglaublich tolle Musik macht und uns ein neues Intro gebastelt hat, eine neue Station-ID, weil wir nämlich den Survey gemacht haben, nämlich die Umfrage, und da kam raus, dass das Intro in seiner Rauschigkeit vielleicht doch zu rough ist, und jetzt haben wir es alles mal ein bisschen softer gemacht und machen die nächsten 50 Folgen, wenn wir noch 50 machen, mit einem neuen Intro, und zur 100. Folge gibt es wieder ein neues Intro und dann ist es sowas wie die Staffel Nummer 3 dann in den nächsten 50 Folgen. Anyway, das machen wir jetzt. Wir hören jetzt die Folge mit Forma Phantasma. Wir freuen uns über das neue Intro und allerletzte Anmerkung, bevor es jetzt losgeht. Lasst doch mal eine Bewertung auf diesen verschiedenen Plattformen, auf denen ihr das hört. Das heißt, manchmal sind das so Sternchen oder irgendwelche Follows, oder macht das mal und sagt allen euren Freundinnen und Freunden, dass dieser Podcast vielleicht okay ist und ihr den gerne hört, und empfehlt es einfach weiter, weil wir haben jetzt 50 Folgen geschafft. Wir machen es dafür, dass es die Leute hören, und wenn das mehr wären, dann ist das super. Und jetzt viel Freude mit der 50. Folge des Hurra-Hurra-Podcasts. Hurra-Hurra, ein Design-Podcast der Burg. Hey, as I said in the introduction before, this is our 50th episode, and this is quite an anniversary episode of that podcast, because we have great guests here, and this is Andrea and Simone from Forma Phantasma. Hey.
Hi.
Hey, nice to see Christian. You.
Yeah, hi, nice to see you, because I can see you, but all the listeners can't see you. But where is you're here? Where are you?
We are in our office in Milan right now. That actually we moved here since only just a little bit more than 1 year, because we have been living and working in the Netherlands for almost 14 years. Mm-hmm. And we still have a small office in Rotterdam, but we basically moved fully to Milan.
How come?
Well, come on, there.
I would say that mainly they were at the beginning was for family issues and for family reason, but then after spending practically half of our life, I would say, in a foreign country, we thought that would have been also nice to come back here and to contribute to our own country. So it was a way of also to come back to our origins. And
okay, this sounds heroic. Yeah, it's much more about the food,
well,
the weather.
Also. And I wanted to get there. Yeah.
The Italian things. I think it was also to do with actually what Andrea said, but also I don't know. We felt that it was time to actually work here, and to we also, you know, we never learned the language, the Dutch language, and at one point while we were really engaging with the local context and so on the other side, we felt, okay, you know, what are we doing here? you know, our families were struggling for several reasons, and it was the time to also move in a different direction. We always felt European, and it was time to sort of just make a shift. Our mm-hmm. life and our way of working didn't change at all.
As you say, making a shift or going for a new direction, maybe to get in the listeners that are not familiar with your work, maybe you could just make a draft wrap up of what your studio is. I just made my note on experimental material investigation. So this is what maybe you used to be, but there is a shift, as you say. So maybe how was former Phantasma and how you think it will become?
Mm-hmm. Well, so me and Andrea, we founded the studio in 2009, and we established our trajectory always with the idea that we would have collaborations with different industries, but at the same time developing independent design projects. And I would say the majority of our work in this moment is based on collaborations. But many of these collaborations comes also in relation to public institutions where we have the freedom to develop a research-based project that we are interested in. Our main focus is in questioning, I would say, the status quo of design, and I would say the ecological, political, and social and discursive possibilities of design. With a specific focus on, I would say, ecology, which does not mean that all the work that we do also on a commercial level respond to this attitude, but it tries definitely to find, I would say, a link between our more research-based practice, which is the core of our practice, and also our commercial responses. We are also engaging with education. We are the head of a department, Design Academy Eindhoven, and we have been organizing educational programs in various different occasions, as you mm-hmm. know. And this is basically it, but I don't know if Andrea, you want to add something.
No, nothing. I think you said it quite well. I think we are very interested in this idea of expansiveness, and I think design in this moment is really looking also beyond its own definition. And I think we are designers that really are interested in doing that. That's why we love to collaborate with different kind of industry. Of course, we do collaborate a lot with design industry, but we touch upon also fashion, automotive. And as Simone said also before, we do a lot of research projects where we also collaborate with disciplines that are beyond the design one. So we work a lot with scientists, philosophers, and et cetera.
But to go back to your question, you know, it is true that at the beginning of our career, we were focusing on many material-based investigations. But then we realized that, you know, for us, it was not enough to just look for new sustainable, for instance, alternatives to oil-based materials, or to look into how to develop materials based on a specific locality, all things that we have done with our work. But we realized that we were interested in this approach, so more material-based, not looking to necessarily the form of design, but more into the processes, because we were interested in engaging from where materials are coming from, their sourcings, material extraction, I would say environmental exploitations, the engagement with different communities, and how design inevitably end up supporting specific infrastructure. So for mm-hmm. us, looking infrastructures of, for instance, material extraction and distribution, for us working on a material level was about a way of saying, okay, can I be the one that actually decide where the material is coming from? You know, how can I transform a resource into a material and then mm-hmm. into an object? And I think with our more recent work, we're not anymore just trying to be the maker, I would say, of that shift, and rather to become the observer, the critical observer of this infrastructure that we are interested in criticizing to possibly make it more responsible in itself and in the material choices that we make as designers.
As I was thinking of what we are going to talk about today, as this was quite of a race to find that date together. I was always developing new questions on, okay, now we talk about this and this and this. There's one question that was all the time on the top roll of what I wanted to know, and this is something that also brought us together, and that is the Design Campus project that you did in the Kunstgewerbe Museum in Pillnitz in Dresden, which is a city in Germany in Northern Europe, or like mid Europe on the Northern Hemisphere, for everybody to know. So I had a look on the project description that is uploaded on the Design Campus website, and I find it very interesting that one thing that you wanted to approach with the students or the participants is to make them critical agents and to go beyond self-referential processes. Can you just talk about a bit what is all that about and how you managed to come to that kind of result or output?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think that specific sentence that you refer to is basically trying to look at design from, and the role of the designer, from a different perspective, which is not about
it's necessarily context for me.
Yes, but also it is looking at design in context. Maybe do you want to elaborate on that?
No, sorry. You're wrong.
Well, this is funny.
I didn't interrupt you. So
no, it's just that I didn't want to talk about design in context, but more about the idea of authorial design. So that when we say like to go beyond the self-referential is to do not design, from the perspective of the self-expression only of the willingness of the designer or the desire of the designer to express its own feelings, ideas, and so on, but to, and
design
then
I come,
exactly, yeah. Then I come to what Andrea said, design exactly. In context, which is more reacting to contextual decisions and not on self-expression desires. Maybe you can elaborate on that.
No, but indeed, like when Thomas Geisler, that is the actual director of the museum, contacted us for thinking about the school, the summer school, we were, of course, immediately thinking about the context of the museum. Because also it's very interesting, this expansive idea of design. And it knows very well that a museum at the end is a collection of objects. And that in time has been, categorized only by its materiality. You know, if you think about all the museum, like the Dresden Museum, but if I think also Victoria and Albert Museum and others, they've been all divided by this materiality. So wood, metal, ceramic, almost removing the context in which those objects and material have been produced and extracted. And for us, it was very interesting to go back to that categorization, but really connecting to what is happening now in the contemporary time, where context and it's the most important things to think about when you produce. So I would say that the School of the Untold, indeed, is that it was the name of the 6 weeks program. It was really to tell the story of the objects that are contained within the museum in a completely different way. So we invited very talented young practices, and not only young, but like different kind of practices. They section it for 6 weeks, some of the most amazing objects contained in the museum collection.
And what objects have that been?
Well, very different. They were all related to those categories, wood, metal, ceramic. So the amazing thing that all the designers choose those objects based also on specific stories, and because they were kind of, in a way, they were very interested in go beyond the official caption that you could find within the museum and try to really understand the colonial past, the social responsibility that object had embedded in it.
Basically, if you think about objects nowadays as they were in the past, they are world makers. But what do we mean with that? Is if you take, for instance, a contemporary object such as a laptop or a cell phone, and if you think about the quantities of materials within such an object, it means also that to produce that object, it's almost as if we as humans, we are reassembling the planet in a new form. We are pushing pieces of land, animal species, and reassemble them in a new Pangea or Pangea. And it's just important, we think, in the design context and in the museum context, to do not accept that objects should be looked only as a study collection for the formal qualities of things, but to look at them for exactly what I said, as world makers. And, you know, we have the idea of the planet in the form of the blue marble, but I could argue that all the objects that surround us are different planets or different forms of reassembling the planet. So when we think about the ecology of an object, it's almost like thinking about the ecology of a planet.
Well, that's a big thesis.
We are okay making bold statements.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. Maybe we can go further then to the ore streams, because that is a project that, by investigating it more in detail, comes to that point that everything contains so much world that you can describe it as a world itself. But coming back to the or just trying to stick on the design campus, I saw two or three final presentations of the works there, and they have been in the result quite not different, but they had different qualities. So some of them have been highly symbolic, working more on a critical or on a speculative, but also on a spectacular level of what these objects are. And some have been quite offering solutions on how to engage with these objects in the collection or as what they are in an historical context, for example. So as design and context is something that is really interesting when it comes to working in a museum, where this context is not only in a present, but also in very different modes of past. And what I wanted to ask is, how did you, I don't know the English word, but how do you made the educators or the trainers or the group of people who conducted the workshop sensible for that approach that you had? So is there a kind of a briefing? Because I don't know, you did not teach one or conducted one group, but you gave it away. So which I really like, because it's an offer, it's an occasion for others to come in. But how did you brought them into that one
umbrella?
Umbrella.
Well, first of all, we selected practitioners that we had a feeling they engage and they understand where we come from and our ideas, but not even our ideas. It's not even about understanding our ideas. It's more like they engage in a similar way with this view of design, and so that. There is also a mutual understanding of what we are trying to do. Of course, they received the brief on what we were trying to achieve with the school. And most of all, also this basic idea of relooking at the study collection of a museum from a contextual perspective. But also on the other side, we encourage them to make their own decision on how they interpret the brief. This we know, this for us was quite important, because also we are, you know, as we explained before, heading a department in Design Academy Eindhoven, but we have also been teaching before. And we also know how important it is to
let it go, indeed,
and let also people interpret.
Yeah, also trust the people you are selecting. I mean, at the end, we selected people that we knew that would deliver ideas not as we would do, but in line with the same kind of thoughts that we have. So, you know, the we are very used to that. I would say also here in the studio, you know, when we work with in our team, it's also about them and how they interpret our brief. So it's, you know, when you work collectively, and also because we are in two, we also trust other opinion and other ideas. I think it's really part of the way we work.
Is the work on the design campus something that is a follow-up, or that is in a linear tradition, or tradition is a big word, but in a linear consequence to what you do with geodesign in Eindhoven, where you have your master class there?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, of course, it's a it's a very different also time scale, because it's a week workshop. But some of the mentors, for instance, that we invited for the design campus are also mentors in geodesign. Ah. I think about Giuditta Venerame, Irakli, and others. So we do have a few of them. They are already, they have been involved in geodesign. So yes, I would say so.
As this is a podcast about design education as well, so but it's mostly a thing that that we are doing, because as we come also from an like experimental teaching practice, as the festival that we did a few years ago was mainly on the question on how do we design and how do we learn how to design. I'm very happy to have you here, because there are like few directions on questions I have on your design practice. First, more on the content and context side, and then later on the question, how do you manage to do it? I just printed out your the teaching goals that you formulated for the geodesign, and the students learn to research and analyze specific themes by engaging with published materials. They develop communication tools. They transform their research results into specific personal assignments. They understand their interests, talents, and weaknesses, and they elaborate their own ideas in writing and collectively edit their research for publication. That is something that I really find very interesting, because it's very interesting what it says, but it's also very interesting what it's not saying, because there is not a focus on formal aesthetic. I see you shaking your head like no, it's not happening.
No, it's important. Yes. I mean, like it's also, you know, I mean, at the end we are all in visual culture, and you know, the people that graduate from the geodesign department are designers, so they of course they need to also think about aesthetic choices. But I would say that we are not. Something that I would add probably in the description you just mentioned is also the fact that it is a not media-based department. So mm-hmm. we are not very interested in just exploring, you know, design because we think, or product design because, you know, we are in a product design department and we should only do objects. Well, no, you know, we can have, like, we have so many other tools that we can use to talk about the product design discipline, and we should explore that. So it's a free form, I would say.
I think it's an attitudinal department.
Yeah, it's an attitudinal department, yeah.
It's not like it's definitely not as the categories we talked about before in the museum, mm-hmm. linked to forms of categories of what kind of design or outcome you do, which presents struggles. Because it could also be that in the years, the department becomes too fluffy or too freeform, but it's better to take that risk, I guess, than categorizing the kind of outcome that the designer should do, because that is a perspective that always came from a commercial desire of providing a service, and that's not what we're interested in doing in education.
What and on what indicates a too fluffiness?
Yes, no, that's a very good question. We will find out soon, I guess, after a few years of heading a department. I guess what I meant is that when you are open, very open on one side, you should also be strict on the other. Mm. And I guess we need, after a few years of having the department, now we're in second, at one point narrow it down again. What I mean to say is that it's very good to be expansive, but at the same time, you also know what the department should not become. Mm-hmm. What should not accept, what should not welcome. But at the same time, I think
you know, well, not welcome, otherwise it sounds bad when you say that.
I think there are things we should not welcome in the department. It's something we have to be open, but we're not going to be welcoming of all ideas, I guess. There's also things for which we stand and things that we should not, support.
Yeah, for instance, something that we all the time need to remind to everybody, but also to our students, is that it is a design course. It's very important that every time we address topics, there needs to come back to design, to the discipline of design. So that's very important, that all the time we come back to our own discipline.
But when it's that is a tricky thing, I guess, because as you widen up the design discipline to research, to experimental use and exploration of materials, crazy shapes with crazy materials. What would you describe then as a core design discipline within on what everything is condensed to point when thinking about engaging with published materials, communication tools, assignments, like all that? I totally share your points here, but I'm very interested in what is the design everybody should come refers to in the end.
Yeah, but indeed it's not so much about the final outcome. For me, it's okay if the final outcome can be a piece of research, it can be an article, it can be a movie, it can be a communication. But what we mean to say is that it should all the time come back to the main discipline that is design.
To design question.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned before, I mean, design is not only about, at the end producing an object, but also really thinking about all the ecology that goes around the design discipline. So,
I think essentially it boils down really to making sure that the questions that are raised are relevant within the design context.
Yeah.
Consider in a broad way. But if all our work, maybe it is easier if we make example with our work, even the one that as outcome, they had an exhibition, they had a publication, they had a lecture series, they had a design campus or educational programs, they were all dealing with questions that we do believe they are related to the design discipline, related to as we discussed before, for instance, the ecology of production, essentially. At least this is what we are interested in. It's the ecology of production. Production, we mean in a way, we still relate to industrial design in a way. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's really about...
Actually, we are just interested in industrial design. Every time, all our projects are about discussing the downfall and the success of the design industry. I mean, when we work on the Botanica, that was a very old project of ours that was dealing about these like pre-industrial plastic. In any case, was almost a critique on the industrial production of plastic nowadays.
And innovation.
And innovation on the idea of innovation. If I think about Cambio, that this project that we did like a couple of years ago for the Serpentine Gallery in London, it was about the timber industry and all the infrastructure that surrounded the timber industry. But again, we are interested in the timber industry, in the extraction of material for production of industrial product.
I think Cambio is a good example because, we could have done an exhibition about wood, right? Mm-hmm. And that is something that you could definitely find in the design tradition. But we did instead an exhibition about the governance of the industry of timber that extract timber from forest. Why? Because we think as designers, we should engage with these questions on how resources, for instance, are extracted and how we understand the relationship between production and the environment from where we extract values. And that for us is a design question. It's definitely related to production.
Mm. Also because
and we see it, sorry, because also, for instance, thanks to that exhibition, we started an ongoing conversation and collaboration with Artec, the Finnish company. Mm-hmm. They could totally relate with some of the questions we're raising with that exhibitions, because they are the questions that they face nowadays as a furniture producer that have a very close relationship with the environment from which they extract timber, which is the Finnish forests. And we are having these in-depth collaborations with them, for instance, in these days, reevaluating the levels of, or how they interpret quality within the company. And we are
in light of climate crisis.
Yeah, and the effect that, for instance, certain specific bugs have on the trees that grows in the Finnish forest, and how they affect, for instance, the amount of discarded wood they have.
But also availability of like A-grade wood that is the highest quality that is becoming rare and rare. And when you have like entire industry, they only rely on a such high quality wood, then, you know, in 10 years time, if you don't start to really think about or redefine what quality means, it's also very difficult to produce in the future, especially when quality only depends on aesthetic quality, features. You know, because the A grade, it's the wood almost doesn't have
any trace of natural features that a tree has.
With these projects, you learn a lot, but you also, as we are talking about the geo, you also transfer that knowledge. How do you do that? How do you bring knowledge from your practice to the students? And that would be some from interest to me, because I'm asking that on a very objective position, but also very subjectively, because I'm a design educator as well, but I'm a designer too, and I extract a lot of knowledge from projects that I do with a team, with a network, with collaborators, with producers, and step by step I just like let this rain into my teaching practice. But is it in the same way as you do it?
Paramount. Yeah, that for us it's so important, the fact that the only way of making the discipline evolve is also about the sharing of ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think 10 years ago it was only about, even before, like all about copyrights and copies, and you know, like being very close in the studio, not sharing what things were doing, people were doing. For us it's the opposite. For us it's all about sharing. Like even a project like Cambio, you know, there is a catalog that it's not a catalog, it's a book where we collected all the interview or part of the interview we did. When we do projects like Cambio, there is a website with actually all the interviews we
Which
did.
It's an archive, essentially.
It's an archive where all the papers that we have been reading throughout the process are available. And those for us also are the foundation for instance, the geodesign course. So when we opened the geodesign, it was actually a couple of months after Cambio opens at the Serpentine. And then we based the first semester on all the research we did. So we really consigned all the research and the contact of people that we've been interviewing and meeting for the project to our students. And they would build on top of it. While developing Cambio and a new project that is coming soon, very soon in Norway, we did like for months and months Instagram post where we're showing day by day like some of the research we were encountering while developing the project. So for us, this idea of sharing is very important.
I could add on that, you know, this does not mean that the process is smooth. It does not mean that, you know, you say to students, well, you know, here it is, this is a platform, appropriate it and work with it. Is that working? Not necessarily. And sometimes you have effective results, sometimes it is a failure.
I think what we are struggling the most in this moment in education is that we would like that the department is not working on fostering the talent of an individual only, but also that all the research that is conducted by individuals would be somehow recorded and archived within the department, so that the kind of knowledge is produced from one year to the other should become a flow, and students in 5 years' time should be able to build upon the research that was conducted in the first year of geodesign. We didn't find yet a way to build a useful tool, a useful culture to have that developing. Sometimes it is also due to the shortness of semesters and assignments. Because it is also a question of how you archive information and how you archive research and how you make available to others.
maybe we need to reform the way we construct thesis projects, for instance, in the department. But there is still a lot to do on that level.
Yeah, you have 3 masters, which is very, very short, isn't it? Like it's 3 masters that your studies are structured in, isn't it?
So there are 3 trimesters and 1 year of graduation. So there are 2 years in total.
Two years only.
Yeah,
but it's very little. Yeah, it's a little time. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what is that is a struggle that I face as well. That that we have a semester, so it's like it's not split into 3, but into 2. But still. From my own practice, I know that a project with a strong ambition can't be done in that little time.
No.
So
no, but again, you see, the way of resolving that is if we don't think that the work and should be concluded by an individual,
mm-hmm.
but a chain of individuals that will work within a department in years and years. The problem is, how do you structure a culture and how do you make those informations available? And how do you allow others to work upon what somebody else have worked previously?
We tried to rebuild this kind of like a platform, but maybe it's also a limitation of money that there are at the moment. Maybe in time we will be able to grow. But, you know, if there are students that are like working on Timber for a semester and they are interviewing people, reading things, and everything has been built for that trimester, then it's gone because they are gone in the department. Of course, it's a pity. But then if you have a place where things are there and then the next year, you know, the next group will start to work again on Timber and then they have already half of the research done by the students before and they need to build up on top of it. So also this idea of working from 1 year to the other with same topics, it's very important and very relevant. Like something that we are also discovering and we are making treasure also in our own practice is that work doesn't finish and or start and finish within an exhibition. So Cambio started with the exhibition at the Serpentine, then it was taking another edition in Prato in Italy, and then it changed a bit. So we added some chapters, also the catalog changed in the second edition, then went to Zurich. Then went to Finland, and then we had this like relation with Artec. Then became for the last Salone a collaboration that we did with Prada. They became a symposium. So you know, also this idea, the project becomes a long-term project. You know, I think it's very interesting because on the other side, with our own practice, more commercial one, we need to be quick. You know, we need to have a project that ends mm-hmm. and start and ends in 6 months. So we do like this very long-term project where you can build up on top of it also in terms of knowledge.
And the students who come to you, do they know from the beginning that that this is the approach? From looking on the outside, your studio is kind of a hubris in between research and I don't know the English expression. In Germany, we say Autorendesign, like which is not like this working as an author, which is a different thing. It's a different type of working and or engaging with clients and all that stuff. So, what is the like as when you meet the students first when they are applying for your department? With what expectations do they come to your class, and is it something where you say, okay, we can fit that expectations, or join in, but we have to work on your expectations?
No, I think that maybe a downside of Design Academy is the students always work on their expectations, and maybe they would, some of them would disagree on that, but the master level, especially also because of the age of the students. They come with a very specific idea of what they are interested in and not, which does not mean they're not ready to learn, to change, to evolve, and so on. But, this is also something that we are learning in this moment. You think of the department in one way, and then you realize that, to be honest, the 90% of the department is built on the group of students that apply and that comes within that education, and then you find yourself seeing your department shifting and changing. And I think that's also okay.
We will have to evaluate this in a few years. Mm. We need to see more.
I mean, we just got our first graduates now in June.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we are also starting now to understand what actually geodesign is and how we need to change it. You know, like which are the projects that for us are successful and the other they are not. So we have to also reassess very soon. But on the other side, like when we think about our studio, it's a way also of, we're also trying to make the studio sustain. You know, like at the end, we are not, we are a commercial practice and we, you know, we need to be sure that we could survive.
Mm-hmm.
So we also like this position of doing commercial and research project because we have also the opportunity to really work in the field. So that's for us, it's also the strength. So maybe I would love that also the students that they are passing by in geodesign, they could also go beyond their bubble, you know, the bubble of being authorial or very self-referential designers, you know, that can really act in the world.
Mm-hmm. Regarding your, let's say it's commercial work, just spinning a bit away from the geo education practice, I find it very interesting on the ore streams where you focus so much on rare earths and where all the materials come from and how they are melted into electronic everyday products. And while scrolling through your website, I saw that you also do consulting with Samsung, for example. And then I saw the results that you display on your website, and they are so incredibly beautiful. That's everything that you do is incredibly beautiful. But as in your statements, you always request responsibility and impact and impactfulness of actions by designers. And then you have the chance to consult one of the biggest tech companies in the world, Samsung. Did you get the chance to address these recycling topics and all that kind of crucial painy points?
So, well, then it's a quite complicated question.
First of all, because we cannot also share.
Okay, easy. Share what you can share. And, yeah, and course, if it's too much, then just raise the flag.
I mean, so I would say something. Every time we work with a new client, we try as much as possible to take the project on our own interest.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we can do that, other time not. In the specific case of Samsung, we were working more on a material finishing
request
mm-hmm. for new application, for new objects they were producing. And of course, our presentation, the first one, was all about that. Then it's not that they are not interested. The problem of these big companies is that they are compartmentalized. So, you know, the material finishing works maybe from a geographical area, like in this case, they were in Milano, while, you know, all the R&D and ecological part to work on a completely different planet are working from Hong Kong or New York. And sometimes when you work with this huge company, they are not communicating between each other. So if you enter on the wrong path, then you cannot have so much impact.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, for us, it was incredible to see how the design process can be splitted in fragments,
mm-hmm.
which we find that as an outcome of a theory based on efficiency, which we don't agree with, which sees fragmentation of knowledges as an efficient way. But one of the basic reasons why we think it is efficient is because you also fragment the responsibilities, which is a huge problem when you deal with the ecology. So we are critical with that attitude. We talked about internally, but I wouldn't say that we could address some of the issues we were interested in addressing, but not because there was no interest from the company, simply because we were dealing with a different department.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we, for instance, had a conversations about ore streams and that for instance, with we did an extensive sort of lecture consultancy to Brown, for instance, about our work and how we were dealing with that. So we have these kind of conversations with some of our partners, and some they remain very like we remain very external. That's mm-hmm. what we are asked to share our knowledge, to share our process, and then the companies decide to do whatever with what we say. And other times, instead, the relationship is much more engaging and long term. For instance, as the one we described with Artec.
Yeah, exactly.
So it also depends how you are called in by a client. Sometimes a consultancy can also be extremely one-directional. You just share ideas that you have, and then you don't know what a company do with it.
Yeah, because I ask that question, why is it everything so extremely beautiful? That is a question that I got from a colleague of mine when I was saying, yeah, I'm going to have that interview with a former Fantasma, and she is very, very much into all your works and could explain everything from Cambio to Allstreams. And there was this one question I asked her, yeah, but now we have the chance to ask a question. So what would that question be? And she's a very professional, very critical person, and she asked, why is everything so beautiful? And then I saw and I rewatched or relooked at your work from that question. And honestly, that question is not so bad, because everything has that incredibly aesthetic high value. Still, the questions that should be raised, or that you intend to raise through your work, are very critical. So
this is a very good question,
but it is also a question that would require to be unpacked much more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there is also many ambiguities also within the question, because even when somebody says, like, why is it everything so beautiful, I could also argue
we should argue, of what kind of beauty are you talking about? Or, I mean, we had people thinking that, for instance, some of our objects, such as Botanica, they were looking really ugly.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's also subjective. In the case of oil streams, for instance, we can be much more specific, for instance, with that work.
Mm-hmm.
When we were looking into oil streams, and we were looking into the problem of electronic waste, we have been bumping so much into pictures of economically disadvantaged countries overflowed by electronic waste, with non-white people working on dumps, that we thought they were becoming, first of all, there was a, like, they were also, many of these pictures, they're also beautifully shot. And I think their beauty is the problem, because it is a process of almost glamorizing or turning. There is a sublime quality of there, of being in the Western world, looking at the disasters happening somewhere else. And for instance, in the process of developing oil streams, we specifically decided, not in the objects only, but also in the films that we've done, to position all the discourse on a much more abstract level, with also a very specific palette of color, which is also rather, I would say, almost innocent-like, but like almost like pastel color, which is also like many of those colors you can also find sometimes in screensavers, in digital tools.
Also, we use the quality of those objects. You know, they are usually perfect, beautiful, impeccable. You know, like, we really use the same quality, aesthetic quality, that those objects has.
But so, for instance, for the film, we really wanted to abstract ourselves from the kind of representation of the doom scenario.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that. In the objects, instead, there is another level, but the objects are extremely complicated. We will need a lot of time to talk about the objects, but the idea was for us to make the objects, first of all, extremely aesthetically impermeable. They look like as perfect, as hermetic as an iPhone, as a computer. But suddenly you have small details that to us they should make you wonder. Like, I don't know, for instance, having a stack of shells of mm-hmm. iPhones supporting the surface of a table, or the carcass of a laptop holding up the surface of a desk. And there, for us, the role that those objects have is in, for instance, asking questions: are those objects coming from where? Are they recycled? Is the surface, is the material, if we see an object such as an iPhone under a table, what does it mean? What is the rest of the table made of? It's almost as if we were trying to have glitches. Mm-hmm. In those glitches, you see where the material is coming from. But this hermetic quality is actually what happens also when you recycle things. You don't. It becomes again a new material. There are no traces where that is coming from. And those objects, instead of were visible and visibly coming from, for instance, we had a microwave used as a shelf. Why should that look recycled, for instance? We were also not going for the recycled aesthetic with the cliche of the recyclessness, I would say, even if you can still totally recognize that. So there were many questions that were coming together in one object. And in the way we think what we think our objects are very often, and we think that as a quality, they are ambiguous. And I think that's a quality because it should make you think of the multiplicity of levels you can read them, so which is exactly what happens in daily objects.
Yeah, so so you focused a lot on the communicativeness, on the symbolic qualities.
I wouldn't say it's symbolic, but I would say it's narrative.
Okay, yeah. So you want to trigger some discourse, some reflection through that glitchiness in the details.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I would also say, sorry, but I mean, if we talk about the object of our streams, it's never ending, but it's important. The object, they very often from people, they have been interpreted as the solution to the research or the outcome of the research, but it's not the case. The outcome of the research was a series of film where we, for instance, described very technical, pragmatic strategies that could be applied nowadays to make electronics more repairable and recyclable. And the objects, in fact, are not at all that. They are more the tool that allowed us to engage with companies to deal with recycling.
Mm-hmm. So we have to produce objects. So we went there and asked him, you need to produce this object in recycled aluminum. Can we talk about how you do it? So they were almost a way to really engage in these discussions.
And yeah, it's also medium. The result of a commission from a museum that was collecting furniture, and they wanted us to collide our research with an outcome which were office furniture. We decided they were making them office furniture.
I just want to end up, maybe it's not the best ending question, maybe it's the question before that. You have a lot of activities. You do the research, you run the office, you have the education practice going on. You have a personal life. Regarding strong development within the studentship that I face is that everybody's taking care a lot of their mental health. How do you manage to get all these things done? Do you have some sort of trick to get all these personalities and compartments of yourself in order?
Well, this does not mean we don't struggle, but maybe Andrea, you should respond to this question.
Why?
Because you're very organized. No, so there is that.
And I think it's a matter of that. I mean, again, I think we also are witnessing a shift within the studio. I think we were at the beginning, we were a few people. Recently, we became around 6-7. Now we are in 10, actually, mm-hmm. almost 11. So now we are also growing a bit. And in all sense, we are getting old, for sure, but we're also growing as a studio. So we are also learning how to make this mess that we do, because at the end, as you said, like we are wearing multiple hats. We're trying to understand how we can divide between all these roles that we have without compromise the work, because that's also okay. That can also be the problem, you know, sometimes that then you start to overlook education, or you overlook the curatorial part, or, you know, you overlook the work. And we are very involved in everything. That's also the problem sometimes, that we would like to let it go sometimes on some work that we feel are important, but they can also be taken from us, you know. So we are learning, but I think it's all about the personal of discipline. It's, you need to be very disciplined, right? When you work, you need to have moments in which you work and moments in which we don't work. So we try to don't work during the weekend as much as we can. We try not to work in the evening. I mean, we work also in the weekend sometimes, but you know, we are also a couple, so we have to be very careful on how we manage everything. So everything becomes very, very complicated.
And I guess also another thing that you need also to be good at is also to, at one point, to decide when the work end, like, and to let it go also, like to know that maybe you could have done more, that it could have been better. You should, I mean, we always strive for the best, but you should also at one point decide when the work is finished. It's more that, and make a point.
Do you always agree on that?
No.
No, but I would say that generally we quite agree on the bigger things. We don't agree on maybe on the path. What we always say is rarely we disagree on the objective. Sometimes we do that. Yesterday, for instance, we were disagreeing on the objective or something. But we agree on the objective, and we can disagree on how to get there. But the main goal, generally, it is shared.
Great. Yeah, that's cool. And so you say it's structure. It's, you have to have some sort of discipline in work to be undisciplined in not work in the end.
It's a bit like when you do sport, right? If you are disciplined, then you achieve your goal, otherwise you don't. I mean, it's easy like that, you know.
You need to train yourself.
Also, it's work, you know what I mean? Like, as much as we have fun, more or less, on what we do, we have, you know, it's a very small percentage. But the rest, it's really about make things.
Actually, this is also another secret.
Yeah.
Do not think that work is fun. It's work is work. Work is professionalism. It's not fun. If you want to have fun, you go to have a beer.
Yeah.
You go to. It can be intellectually fulfilling, but fun is a different thing. You don't have fun when you work. You can be intellectually pleased. You can be engaged. You are passionate.
Love what you do. Yeah, exactly.
You can love it, but the fun is, it's you have it somewhere else. And I think we always say that it's also important to talk about creativity in these terms, because the non-creative, they think we all have fun all the time.
So
why they should pay less.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a trick. And that's also quite a good finishing word. Guys,
so we can have fun now.
Now we can have fun. Yeah, that's great. So even this is work. Honestly, I'm not sure if I fully agree on that. But it gives me quite a good thing to think about. I'm not the most disciplined person. That's why I sometimes have fun while working. So
we also have fun. I mean, this is what we're having now in this moment is work, but it, you know, it's pleasant. It's, but what I mean to say,
it should not be sufferance, of course. Then.
Yeah, it should not be, you know, there's plenty of good things about working, but it's not,
It's not work, it's not necessarily a form of entertainment.
Yeah. Cool. Guys, thanks a lot for your time. Thanks a lot for your insights and sharing your thoughts and ideas on things. It was great. I just have to say also thank you as a person living in Dresden for bringing all the beautiful people into the city. That is that was good, and that this is something that also goes out to Thomas and Jasmin for making it possible, and also to you and all your great tutors sharing the knowledge, plus all the participants coming in. I say thank you and hope to see you soon, and wish you good luck with all your projects.
Thank you for everything, going and thank you on. For the patient also.
Yes.
Very fun conversation.
Cool, thanks a lot. Ciao.
Hurra, hurra, ein Design-Podcast der Burg.